Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our fourth lecture in the Austrian Macroeconomics course. I can't believe that the semester has flown by so quickly. It's almost two-thirds complete. Any case, I hope it's much nicer where you are than where I am. It's raining atrociously here. So let's start this lecture with the point at which I ended up in the lecture last week, which was with how the Fed controls the money supply, what tools are available to the Fed. So let's start with, which I think we already mentioned, the open market operations, but we'll go through, there are basically three tools. So what's important to realize is that the money multiplier, which we talked about, which was one divided by the reserve requirement. So if that's 10%, that's 1 divided by 0.1. It's actually more complicated than that in the real world. Times bank reserves. So for example, if the money multiplier is 10 and the Fed has injected $80 billion of reserves into the banking system, then you would have a money supply of 10 times 80 billion or 800 billion. Now that, of course, that does not take into account the leakages that I talked about last week. I mean, the money multiplier is much less than that. On the one hand, banks keep excess reserves, so not all reserves are lent out. And secondly, reserves are withdrawn from the banking system by people who want to cash in their accounts for currency. So in the real world, it's probably closer to 1.5 or 2, the money multiplier. And we know then, just from looking at that equation, that the Fed can change the money supply by either altering the supply of bank reserves or, alternatively, by changing the money multiplier. And I'll show you how the Fed would change the money multiplier. So the way the bank influences the reserves directly is through open market operations, which we talked about. That's the purchase and sale of U.S. government bonds. Up until very recently, it was strictly Treasury bills on the open market, okay, mainly to 20 or 30 privileged dealers that are called primary dealers that the Fed buys from and sells to. So just to go through it, I think went through this last week, but when the Fed buys a bond from a bank, it pays by depositing the new reserves, let's say it buys a $10 million bond from a bank, it then creates and deposits $10 million of reserves in the bank's reserve account at the Fed. And it just wires the bank that you now have a credit, you have $10 million more dollars of reserves. And so there's nothing tangible. The bank itself merely is notified that it can now lend up to $10 million more than before. And so then it will proceed to do that, and through the money multiplier, the money supply will increase. And we know that if the Fed wants to withdraw reserves from the banking system, it can merely reverse that operation. It can sell government bonds. The bank would then pay for it with a check, let's say a $10 million check, to buy the bond from the government. And when it does that, the check is cleared. The Fed simply subtracts $10 million from the bank's reserves. And the bank has $10 million less dollars to loan out. The Fed also makes loans to banks. This is another way that it can affect the amount of reserves. The old method was called the discount window. Banks that were in trouble that could not get loans from other banks, most banks borrow from each other overnight on the Fed funds market. And that means it's simply an overnight loan. But if a bank is having problems or is perceived to be having problems, then it will have to go to the Fed to get these overnight loans, which allows it to fulfill its reserve requirements, okay? Because at the end of any day, some banks have more reserve requirements, more reserves that they're holding than they need by law, and they want to earn interest on these things. So they'll loan it out to banks who, at the end of the day, find they have insufficient reserves. It's a little more complicated than that, but there's a Fed funds market, and those reserves are loaned out from the banks with surplus reserves to the banks with insufficient reserves at an interest rate. Then the next day, the money is paid back. It's usually not more than one night long. During the financial crisis, the Fed was able to or devised another way of flooding the banking system with so-called liquidity, which is merely just inflating again, and that's called the term auction facility. Okay, and in this case, the Fed doesn't loan specific banks. What it does is it simply sets a price for reserves, and it or rather actually takes bids from banks who want to borrow reserves from the Fed, and then pays out a certain amount of reserves that it has decided to inject to the highest bidders, those who are willing to pay the highest interest rates. Okay, that's never been done before 2008, 2009. So the more that banks borrow from the Fed, either through the traditional method of the discount window or through the term auction facility, the more reserves we have in the system. And one other thing about the discount window, in the old days, before the financial crisis, banks did not want to borrow from the Fed. Because once a bank borrowed from the Fed would begin to look at the bank very closely, to look at their financial affairs, to see why they cannot get loans at reasonable rates in the Fed funds market from other banks. But now that's sort of not any longer the case. Now, the Fed can change the reserve ratio. Now, the reserve ratio doesn't change the amount of reserves. It changes the multiplier. So if you tell a bank that it has to hold 10% reserves, and then you double that to 20% reserves, that means that the reserve multiplier falls from 1 over 0.1, which is 10, to 1 over 0.05, which is 20. Oh, I'm sorry, the other way around. They raise it 20%, so it's 1 over 0.2, which is 5. So the higher the reserve ratio is, the lower the money multiplier is. That is, the fewer times a dollar of reserves can be multiplied. So the Fed can actually double the money supply overnight, again, abstracting from the fact that banks are holding excess reserves. If, say, tomorrow we woke up and they said, you no longer have to hold 10%, you now only have to hold 5%. So if there were $1 trillion in reserves and you only had to hold 10%, well, then the money supply would be $10 trillion. But if suddenly you only had to hold 5%, well, then it's 20 times that $1 trillion. The money supply would explode from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. Again, that's not going to happen now. First of all, because the Fed would never change reserve requirements that radically. They change them very, very, very infrequently because it's such a powerful tool. And secondly, these banks are currently holding excess reserves. They probably wouldn't loan some more out, but it wouldn't be a massive expansion of the money supply, at least not in today's situation. And also the Fed has paid interest on reserves, which encourages the banks to hold excess reserves. So when you don't see many good lending possibilities out there, where many firms don't look like they're going to be making profits, then you're going to look at the point about 0.25% per year that the Fed paid you on the reserve, and you're going to leave them there. You should be earning something on them, and they will not be at risk. So whenever the Fed raises the interest rate that it would pay on reserves, banks would keep more excess reserves at the Fed, and that would decrease the money multiplier. So the Fed controls both the amount of reserves and the money multiplier. And we already mentioned this, but the Fed has problems controlling the money supply. First of all, as I mentioned, if households want to hold more of their money's currency, banks would have fewer reserves and there'd be fewer loans, and the money supply would fall. So, for example, during Christmas, the holiday season from the end of Thanksgiving to through Christmas, there's a tremendous increase in the demand for currency because people are buying small presents, making small payments. So they go to their banks and their ATMs and they withdraw a lot of currency from the system, billions of dollars. And that would mean that the money supply would shrink because for every dollar that someone pulls out, that's $10 of checkbook money that is destroyed, okay, because every dollar supports $10 of bank deposits. So the Fed, to offset that, knows this fact about the Christmas shopping season, and the Fed goes into the market and expands, and through open market operations, it expands reserves. So it begins to buy government bonds to offset the money that's flowing out to the households. So the Fed can offset this thing, okay, and it does, especially where it knows it's going to occur, as in the seasonal shopping type example. And then also, as we just talked about, if banks hold more reserves than they're required to, as they're doing today, much more, then they make fewer loans and money supply falls. And once again, the Fed can offset this through open market operations, okay? That is, it can buy bonds from the banks, and the banks then would have even more reserves than they really want to hold, and would loan them out. So that's the conclusion here. The Fed can compensate for the household behavior and bank behavior, okay? So over the medium run, it has pretty precise control over the money supply. And then bank runs, let's say a word or two about that. When people expect their banks in trouble, they run to the bank and throw their funds. And the more people that do that, the more incentive it gives other people to do it. So that's a classic bank run. People told us that this would not occur again after FDIC insurance. Yet in 1990, 1991, there was a run on some of the savings and loan banks, and they collapsed, and almost wiping out the whole savings and loan industry. And then again, during the latest financial crisis, there were runs, especially among people who were holding deposits at a given bank of more than $100,000, because deposit insurance only covers you up to $100,000 per name on an account. Okay, so you could be, if you and your wife, for example, each have $100,000 in an account, then under separate names, then that's covered. Okay, but if one person has more than $100,000, supposedly that amount's not supposed to be covered. But the Fed has always bailed people over the limit out, but people weren't so sure that was going to happen during the financial crisis. So you did get a run, especially among big depositors. And of course, this is an inherent feature of fractional reserve banks. Okay, they don't have enough reserves to pay off all depositors. That's what fractional reserve means. You only keep a fraction of the deposits on reserve. And also, when some banks begin to have a run, other banks will hold more reserves so that they can meet a bank run in case it occurs, okay, among their customers. So that decreases the money supply also. So that will increase or and reverse the process of money creation, okay, causing the money supply to fall. Okay, let's ask how well the Fed has performed. Okay, first of all, how do we judge the Fed? When it was established in 1914, it was supposed to stabilize the economy, the dollar. It didn't immediately take on the task. It was supposed to provide money for the needs of business. It didn't immediately take on the task of trying to stabilize the price level until the 1920s. Okay, that began to be seen by the Fed itself as its primary job, to stabilize prices. So you can notice there, if you look at, and I'll put the cursor down here. If you notice in the 1920s, prices seemed pretty stable, right, from 20 to 30. In fact, they were, but there was such a tremendous increase in productivity in the American economy after World War I due to improvements in technology. We got more, we had refrigerators now being produced. We had electricity spreading to all American households. Radios were invented, and people were purchasing radios. automobiles were being mass produced for the first time since the war began. They were for a few years before World War I. In any case, the Fed did do its job of keeping prices stable, or the job that it thought was the job that it should be doing. But in fact, prices should have been falling because goods are becoming less scarce. You had economic growth. So despite the fact that prices didn't change, we had a huge boom in the stock market and real estate and other areas during the 1920s. And it culminated, according to the Austrian economists, in the collapse of the stock market in 1929, the collapse of Florida real estate, and we had a depression that followed. Okay, despite the fact that the price was completely stable and that people like Irving Fisher, who's sort of the early founder of monetarism, okay, and Milton Friedman called him the greatest American economist who ever lived, he was claiming even until 1929, the era of depressions are gone, we have an era of perpetual prosperity. Okay, so he thought it was great that prices were stable, and yet with stable prices we had a massive depression. Because the fact we had inflation and lower interest rates and an asset bubble, like we did in the 90s, like we did in 2000, and that in fact was distorted the whole structure of production, which we'll talk about later today, what the structure of production is and why it's so important in explaining business cycles. But let's look what happened. So in 1933, we went off the gold standard, and so we're still in the middle of the Depression, though, and prices started to rise even during the Great Depression, and then they went up right after World War II, after the price controls were taken off, right about here. Okay, notice the prices are going up now. And then we went back on a form of the gold standard, a phony, watered-down gold standard that was called the Bretton Woods system, in which only the U.S. dollar was convertible into gold, and then only for those foreign governments and central banks, not for U.S. citizens. So the phony gold standard, but still, if the U.S. inflated too much, it would lose a lot of its gold, and as a result, because its price would be higher, no one would buy our exports, and our imports would increase as people tried to buy lower price countries. So the U.S. did engage in a lot of inflation that was high relative to other countries, so the price levels did go up. During the 1960s in particular, it's going up here, if you can see. And the reason why was because the politicians, both John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, both wanted to fight the Vietnam War, and Johnson in particular also brought in the War on Poverty, in which he wanted to fund massive social welfare programs, Medicare. Was passed and so on, but he didn't want to have to raise taxes to pay for the war and to pay for this extra social spending. So to make a long story short, we had more money printing and the prices began to rise. We had inflation. Eventually, because of the inflation, we began to lose a lot of our gold. Okay, in 1968, Germany and France began to make noises in the late 60s that they wanted their gold back. Germany's was an occupied country, American troops there, they were dependent on the U.S. The U.S. threatened France and Germany that if they took their gold out, if they turned in their dollars, which were far in excess of the amount of gold we had at this point, that the U.S. would have to withdraw its nuclear umbrella, that it's defense against the Soviet Union. The French didn't pay attention. The French developed their own nuclear force. They dropped out of NATO for a while. They sent a warship to pick up their gold, okay, because obviously if they sent a civilian ship, there could have been an accident, okay, something could have happened. So they sent a warship, and they got their gold out. The Germans knuckled under. But anyway, by the time we got to 1970, 71, the inflation was so high, okay, prices now had doubled from 1920 or so, if you look like from about an index of 20 up to an index of 40 here. We weren't competitive. We weren't selling exports. On the other hand, our consumers were buying a lot of imports. So we had to pay for them in full because we weren't earning enough from our exports to pay for all the imports. And we began losing gold, and towards the end of 1970-71, the U.S. had something like $9 billion left in its gold stock, and we owed the rest of the world something like $80 billion in U.S. dollar liabilities that foreigners had and could have turned into gold. So at that point, there was a big run on the dollar, and I won't get into the details of this, but it was estimated that within 2 weeks' time, we would have lost all our gold. So we went up the gold standard. So after 1971, look what happened to the price level. Okay, so we completely cut out all links with gold in 1971, and then the price level goes from around 40 in 1971 to almost 240 today. That means prices increased by more than five times. So prices, you know, an automobile was something like $2,500 in 1971, okay, and now it's, you know, the similar middle-class automobile or, you know, middle-level automobile is $25,000 now. So prices just skyrocketed. And this is the era from here through today of pure fiat money. Absolutely no country has any link to gold any longer. Okay? And you can see what kind of a job the Fed did. Okay? So we can just look now, go to some figures here. So let's take the following. If you have $22.57 in last year, let's say 2012, that has the same purchasing power as a dollar did when the Fed began in 1914. So it takes you 22 and a half times more money to buy the same good today. That means that basically the dollar is worth a nickel today compared to what it was worth in 1914. And then just to go on, if you compare it from 1933 when we went off the gold standard completely, a dollar in 1933 would take $17.23 to buy what a dollar purchased in 1933. So that's a huge drop in the purchasing power of the dollar. And finally, if you go, actually two more things, if you look at 1971 when we went off the phony gold standard, it would take you now $5.67 to buy what you could have gotten for a dollar in 1971. Okay, so prices went up by more than five and a half times, nearly six times, just since 1971. And then if you go to 1984, which many economists claim is when the central banks began to understand how to control inflation, the price level is still more than double. It was called the Great Moderation. From 1984 until the financial crisis, the bursting of the bubble, economists claim that all central banks are doing a great job, okay, which of course is not the case. They caused these financial bubbles. But aside from that, even if just looking at the prices, which is what all the central banks look at, just look at consumer prices. Consumer prices more than doubled. Okay? So I don't think that's such a great performance on the part of the Fed at all. And then you compare that to the gold standard. So in 1914, the dollar had more purchasing power than the dollar in the year 1800 did. It means that prices actually fell by 20% because it only took you 80 cents in 1914, right before the Fed began, to buy something that would have cost you a dollar in 1800. So prices fell throughout the 19th century in the U.S. for the gold standard. And if you take that up to 1896, and that's before we had big gold discoveries in South Africa, the price level had fallen from a dollar to 67 cents. A dollar in 1800 to 67 cents in 1867. So the value of the dollar increased by 33% or so, or more, actually. Near 50%, okay, over those years. And then it was considered to be a great inflation under the gold standard. If you look at the fourth bullet point, when gold was discovered in South Africa, and also they had a new process for refining gold, that lowered the cost of refining gold. You got a lot more gold coming into the economy, and you had an expansion of the money supply. So prices did go up, but they only went up from, let's say, a dollar to a dollar 19. We're up by 19% in about 18, 19 years. So it's about 1% per year, which was considered a big inflation in those days, just going up by 1% per year. Okay. So the gold dollar, even one that's controlled by government, you know, government interfered with the gold standard throughout the 19th century, especially after the Civil War, but yet it still performed better than the Fed. Okay. So that ends the lecture on money. And what I want to do now is to talk a little bit about capital and the structure of production. Remember, the other part of macroeconomics from the Austrian point of view is not just money, because money is traded on all markets, but it's also the interest rate. And the interest rate is involved in most transactions. Whenever somebody trades something like their labor, say somebody's building involved in building a factory, that's not going to come online for a number of years. Well, that person is trading labor today or getting income today, and the employer is not getting, I mean, the employer doesn't care about the labor that he's getting today, except in as far as it will help him to sell more goods 5 years down the line. So he's exchanging present goods, he's giving present money to the labor, which is called wages, and we'll get back to this, in exchange for future goods, that is expected income from the product of labor that's going to be sold on the market 5 years from now. So let's talk a little bit about production and what we call time preference in Austrian economics. The first thing about production is true for whether or not you're producing an automobile from scratch or you're producing a ham sandwich in your home. Okay, it always takes time. Okay, from the time that you begin making the ham sandwich, getting the ingredients together, expending your labor, it might take you a half hour, or if you're preparing a more elaborate meal, an hour and a half. So even in your daily life, all acts of production take time and are oriented towards the future. Okay, all action is intended to bring you greater satisfaction at some point in the future. Could be the near future, could be an hour away, could be 5 minutes away, but it's always forward-looking. Production is always forward-looking. And also it takes place in stages. There are different steps that you have to go through before you can arrive at the final product. So that's the truth of human action. So that's the first bullet point. And then we come to the law of time preference. And that can be stated, this law can be stated in a number of different ways. One is that time is scarce, so people prefer to achieve their goals sooner rather than later. And we always add all other things equal, okay? So, for example, if someone is offered the opportunity to have ice and it's the middle of the winter, well, ice doesn't have as great a satisfaction to that person as it would in the middle of summer. So he would prefer to take the ice for delivery six months from now. That does not violate the law of time preference. That simply says that all other things equal, the other things are not equal. That ice today doesn't have to give the same satisfaction, doesn't satisfy the same needs as ice does in the summer. And you can go through many examples like that. And then secondly, another way of saying it is that everyone values a good or satisfaction or sum of money. Probably the best way to put it is everyone values a satisfaction available in the present to the same good available in the future. As we'll see, this law of time preference will underlie interest and a lot of other phenomena in the economy. And I, as I explained to some of my undergraduate students, you can look around you and see that this is always true. If you try to think away the law of time preference, you end up in an absurd situation. So, for example, if you come home, if I go home from this lecture and I'm hungry and I have a frozen dinner, and hopefully I'll have a fresh meal, not a frozen dinner, I have a frozen dinner in the in the freezer. If I had no time preference, that is, if I preferred satisfaction consistently in the future rather than in the present, then I wouldn't eat the frozen dinner, because today the frozen dinner would have a higher value in the future if time preference did not exist. Okay. And then when tomorrow came, I wouldn't eat the dinner either. And so on. So any good that's not perishable, no one would ever use, because no one would have a greater satisfaction in the future than in the present. That is, if there was no time preference. But of course there is. And that's why we do eat the dinner today. Okay. So that would be one absurdity. And basically, the only people who do not have time preference are dead people. Okay. As long as you're acting, as long as you're doing anything to get closer to your goals, beginning to cook the meal or taking it out of the freezer, you are pulling forward in time the satisfaction. You're pulling it out of the future into the present. Okay? And so that means that you're exercising time preference, or you're expressing your time preference. Another example I give is, let's say that there's a male that likes a female. I'll go from my point of view, since I'm a male. And wants to ask her out on a date. So in a world of no time preference, let's say he asked her out, and she said, he says, can we go out next week? And he responds, or rather she responds to him, well, I'm busy next week. And he said, what about the week after? And she says, no, I have plans. But what about, you know, sometime next month? Geez, I'm really booked up, let's say she tells him. And then he says, well, when can I call you? And let's say she responds, well, call me in 5 years. So in the real world of time preference, we would take that as a brush off, right? But in a world of zero time preference, people would say, oh, it's great. I prefer to have the date with you 5 years from now than today. Okay. So the whole thing is absurd. Okay. You can't think of a world where there is no time preference. Okay. As long as people are acting, they're pulling their satisfactions closer to them in time. Okay. And that's what time preference means. To prefer something, a satisfaction, earlier rather than later in time. All other things equal. So now let me talk a little bit about a loan transaction and show you why there might be interest involved, the time preference involved in loan transactions. So if we go to the first loan transaction, which is here, let's assume that I ask you to loan me money, $10,000, and you trust me, despite the fact that my name is ends in a vowel and I come from New Jersey, you trust me that I'm going to pay you back. That is, you are willing to loan me you're completely confident, let's say, that I will pay you back the full $10,000 in 1 year's time. Okay, even with that, those conditions, would you loan me the $10,000 today? For an IOU saying I'll pay you back $10,000 in the future. So we're abstracting from uncertainty or from any malicious intent on my part. We're saying that you do trust me. Okay, of course you wouldn't. But that's because of time preference. That's because $10,000 today can bring you present satisfaction. Whereas if you loan that to me, you postpone satisfaction for a full year that you could acquire with that money. So the bottom line is that in order for me to get you to give me present dollars, I have to bribe you by offering more future dollars. So time preference also means that present dollars have a greater value than future dollars. And that's all interest is. Okay? Forget about the interest rate. Okay? Interest is simply, if you look at the diagram that I have here, the first one, the borrower wants the $10,000 in present dollars. So the lender, if you look on the right side here, the lender, has $10,000 present dollars. But to give you those $10,000 present dollars, which you prefer to a certain amount of future dollars, you have to bribe him to part with the present dollars. Because to him, a present dollar is worth more than a future dollar. So he may take your deal if you promise, or if you give him an IOU, for $11,000 future dollars. Okay? Now, we could say, well, that's the 10% interest. But that's not the fundamental underlying exchange. The exchange is present money for a greater promise of a greater sum of future money. So the lender is willing to part with the $10,000 today only if you give him a premium, and that's the interest premium. If you give him $1.10 for every present dollar, you promise to return $1.10 a year from now. Okay. So loan transactions are affected by time preference, obviously. And now let me talk a little bit about a recent or relatively recent lending practice called payday lending, which was brought into being as a way of getting around usury laws on the part of governments. So governments in many states will say that no one can charge more than 15% or 20% or let's say 30%. Say no one can charge more than 30% per year for a loan. And that's, of course, supposedly protect the lower-income workers. Well, of course, it doesn't, because you might have banks and other conventional lenders refusing to loan to a person who has no credit history, who's had some defaults in their past and so on, at 30%. They may only think it's reasonable to do it at 50% or 60%. So that person then turns to a loan shark. So you force people who don't have good credit histories, who don't have good credit ratings, don't have a lot of assets and so on, you force them to deal with illegal loan sharks. Well, one way to get around this, not all states have these laws, one way to get around these usury laws, UFURY, is to have something called payday lending. And so in this example, and this is actually a real example, it comes from North Carolina, the average amount of a payday loan is $244. So here's what happens. The worker goes to a payday lender, small operation, and banks are just starting to do this now. Okay, this has been going on for years. Banks are just starting to engage in payday lending. And he writes them out a check. Okay, let's say in this case, he writes out a check for $280. That's payable in 2 weeks. Okay, so he postdates the check for 2 weeks. Okay, he says no money in his account. In the meantime, the payday lender gives him $244 present dollars. Okay. At the end of the 2 weeks, he has to pay back $280. Okay, when he gets his next paycheck. So that's a huge rate of interest. That's 300 or 400%. If you figured that out on a per annum basis, paying back, $36 for $244 loan over 2 weeks, that's a huge interest payment. Okay, that's a big interest rate on that loan. The point is, though, it doesn't matter. What matters is that the worker is getting present dollars and prefers the $244 present dollars to the $280 future dollars that he has to give back in 2 weeks. Okay, because he has very high time preference. People who pay high interest rates have very high time preference. So instead of criticizing the payday lender, you know, which is done all the time, the people criticized are those who will not lend at a lower rate. The payday lender is lending at the lowest possible rate because obviously the worker wouldn't borrow from him or her if the worker could find a lower rate somewhere else. So payday lenders are extremely beneficial to those who don't have a lot of wealth or don't have good credit histories or who have gone bankrupt in the past, okay? And that allows these people to, when they pay back the loans, to begin to get some kind of credit rate. But the whole point, again, is to emphasize it comes back to what we call time preference, okay? So the interest rate, by the way, the rate 5% or 10%, whatever is quoted, is really a statistical construct. It helps businessmen to figure out which of the many different investment and loan projects is most profitable to them. Okay, it gives them a common denominator for different size loans and investments. Okay, but what's really happening is what I've shown you here. It's simply future and present sums of money being exchanged. The difference in the number of future dollars that has to be given for present dollars, you can subtract the amount of present dollars from the future dollars, and then take the future dollars here, it's 1,000, divide by the present, take the extra future dollars, divide by the present, that's the interest rate, it's 10%. Okay, here it might be for a year, I think 280% or 300%, something like that. But the principle is the same. Okay, so now I want to go into a little bit more into defining a time preference. So we're going to call time preference in this course TP for time preference. And in our everyday lives, it's expressed in the ratio of the income that we spend on consumption goods and the income that we invest, okay, save and invest in interest-producing assets. So let's take two people, which I do here. One person, person A, and let's assume they both have the same income, $1,000 per month. One person takes $800, spends on consumption, and takes the balance, $200, and invests it. Now, that doesn't mean holding it as money in your pocket. That's hoarding. That's not consumption. That's not investment or saving. Okay. Saving is different from hoarding. Saving is actually buying something, even directly investing in a business by buying various assets. If you own a small dry cleaners, so you invest in more equipment and so on. Or it means going to a financial intermediary like a bank or a money market mutual fund and buying shares in the mutual fund or buying a certificate of deposit from the bank. That is saving. So you're actually buying when you save. Okay, you're just buying different things. You're buying investment goods, ultimately, because the bank loans the money out, and the money that is used by the borrower to invest in capital goods. So person A has a consumption-saving ratio of 4. That is, for every $4 spent on consumption, $1 saved. Person B, who has the same income, has a 1-to-1 ratio. So they save half their income, they invest the other half. Okay, we say that the person who has the higher consumption saving ratio is the person with the higher time preference. They prefer the present more strongly than does the other person. Okay, person B. Okay, everyone has positive time preference. Everyone prefers to spend something on their current wants and desires. That is, everyone's continually pulling satisfactions closer to them. But some people have a stronger preference for the present than others. And so in this case, person A is. I mean, it could be a person C that spends their whole income right away. And so they, as soon as they get any money, they spend it. So they have an extremely high time preference. So that's explained in the third bullet point here. So we're going to be referring to people with high time preferences. They tend to be the lenders. People with low time preference, okay, who have low consumption saving ratios, are the lenders. The people with high time preference, with high consumption saving ratios, tend to be the borrowers. Okay, some people will actually use all their income and then borrow more. Okay, and they're higher time preference. Now. Is everyone just sort of born with higher or low time preference? Can it ever change? Does it change over people's lives? Well, yeah, there are changes in time preference. It's not constant, even from one person. So it can change with your, as I show here, it can change with your income, okay? As your income grows, your time preference will generally fall, all other things equal. It changes with your age, for sure, as we'll see. And there are other circumstances, okay? And if you take different people who have the same income, that are in the same age and so on, their time preference will be different. So nobody's time preference is determined by anything. It's a result of free will, okay? So let's look at the typical life cycle, time preference life cycle. So when your kids are young, or when you're a child, or if you have children, you'll realize, as I did, children want everything, and they want it now. They want it right away. So when I used to take my son, we used to go to a particular diner to eat, there were video games in the front of the diner. And of course, before we even ate, he wanted to play video games. And they, back then, they cost about 25 cents. So I would tell him, look, I'll let you play after we and I'll give you two quarters. I'll let you play two games, two quarters instead of playing one now. And so that's like it's 100% per hour interest payment to the kid. But of course, he would refuse it. Why? These kids don't think past just a few minutes. I mean, they want everything now. So when children typically have very high time preferences, as people become young adults, they begin to mature and they begin to postpone some of their satisfaction. That is, they save more. They think about the future a little bit more. And then in middle age, when people are looking toward retirement, their time preferences really fall, okay? They begin to stop buying the toys that young adults might buy, motorcycles, the expensive vacations, and they begin to put aside money for the retirement, okay? So that's a life cycle, your time preference falls. But then when they move to old age, okay, you only have a few years left, or you only have, a decade left, or whatever, you don't have much time left. People often say that, well, my mother or father was older, they're living through their second childhood. What that means is that they want everything now to begin to spend on things that they would have never spent on earlier in their lives. So time preferences start off very, very high for people, generally, and then fall as you approach middle age, and then rise at old age. Okay. The sociologists have pointed out that criminals have very high time preferences. Some people who do stupid things, like rob a bank and know that they're going to get caught or commit a crime in full view of others without wearing a mask and so on. Some may be doing this because they're stupid, but others are doing it because they have very high time preference. That is, they want that satisfaction of all that money right now, and they'll try to spend it real fast, and they're not thinking a week or 2 weeks away when they're caught by the cops. Okay. As I said, as a given person tends to have more money, he tends to think more about the future. Okay, but that's not always true. Okay, as your income rises, you tend to spend less on current consumption, a less proportion on current consumption than you do on saving. Okay, but as your income is going up, then your time preferences tend to get lower. But that doesn't have to happen. I mean, if you compare different people, you find that, there are immigrants that, don't have much at all that come to the U.S., but they save a tremendous amount, despite the fact their income is very low, and you have playboys living off their, money that their family has, the father or, grandfather has made through various business investments and so on. And they squandered all, okay? Preventive medical care, it turns out that people, middle-class people, tend to have habits that treat their body, middle-class and upper-middle-class people, they treat their body as an investment good, that they want to operate in a way that keeps it in good operating condition through old age. Whereas many people, let's say the underclass, many people that are on welfare and so on, not just because they're poor, but they have certain habits that keep them poor. And one of them is that they treat their body as a consumption good. That is, they'll drink to excess, they'll take drugs and so on, they'll wear their body out, they won't get their teeth repaired and so on. Okay. Because they do have money, they'd rather spend it on drugs and dental care and things like that. And that's not everyone, not every poor person by any means, but preventive medical care is an example of someone showing foresight for the future of putting aside current pleasures and spending money on maintaining their health and their vitality. And two examples I often give my class. One is, let's say that we all find out on the front page of the newspaper tomorrow, it's announced that a new drug has been discovered by scientists that will double the average human lifespan, let's say from 70 to 140 years. What would you find on the business page on that very day, okay, or the very next day? Interest rates plummet. okay, interest rates would fall and die. Because people would, in a normal economy where the Fed is keeping them at zero, in a normal economy, what would happen is that people would say, you know what, I got 70 more years, more than I thought. So they're going to look further into the future. Their time preference, they want to provide for a longer period in the future. So their time preferences will drop. They'll start to consume less, spend less on consumption, save more, and that will push interest rates down. Okay. On the other hand, if an opposite, there's something like B here, where there's a meteor, suddenly discovered that a meteor will crash into the Earth in a year, wiping out, say, most of the population of the Earth, people would suddenly develop very high time preferences. Okay, very responsible people, because nothing will mean anything after a year. Everything will be gone, so including your own life. So bottom line is that that would cause interest rates to skyrocket. Nobody would give you a loan for, everyone would want to spend their money now. There'd be very few loans that were given, and they would be given at very, very high rates, you know, like, you know, 500% for a 3-month loan or something like that. Okay, now let me just talk a little bit more about some laws of human action, which we already sort of discussed, but as they may relate to production, okay? So the first thing to realize is that there's a law of maximum utility or law of total utility, the first number one here, and that's true. Everybody prefers a greater quantity of a good to a smaller quantity. So you prefer 3 DVDs to 2 DVDs to 1 DVD. Okay. To the extent that something remains a good to you, if something scarce to you, you prefer more of it than less of it. Okay, and that's going to be important to understand production and the structure of production. And we call that the law of maximum utility, the law of total utility. The second law, and this is that all people value a quantity of goods available sooner more highly than an equal quantity of goods available later. Again, all other things equal, meaning equal satisfactions. And that's, of course, a restatement of the law of time preference. And so that means you prefer an iPhone today, and I just got my iPhone 5 2 weeks ago, I didn't want to wait longer, to an iPhone in 2 years, and you prefer an iPhone in 2 years, okay, that it's greater than, has greater value, that's what that symbol tells you here, to an iPhone in 5 years. That's the law of time preference. Okay? And then a third law of human action you have to keep in mind, that some processes of production, some longer processes of production, meaning ones that have longer steps and take a longer time to complete, are more productive than shorter processes of production. Okay? And now that's more of an empirical fact. We look around the world, we find that that's true. Now I'll give you an example of that. It doesn't have to be all longer processes. All longer processes of production are not more productive than shorter ones. There are many productive short processes of production. So an example of that number three. Here's an example of where a longer process is more productive than a shorter process. Let's say your goal is to catch fish. Well, you can catch more fish per day with the same number of workers if you first build a boat and a net. Okay, then if you simply quickly put together some fishing poles and have the laborers fish off the dock. So even taking into account the time it takes and the labor hours it takes to build the boat, okay, it's obviously longer. Taking that into account, you're still producing, when the boat is completed, let's say after 6 months and that's completed, you still will have more productivity. Okay, so you catch more fish in any given year, that will more than make up for taking 6 months off from catching fish to build a boat. Okay, assuming you can make the fishing pole in one day. Okay, so the fish you catch over 5 years with the boat far exceeds the fish that you catch even starting from day one, simply using fishing poles. Okay, and then there's something else you have to keep in mind. There are some highly valued goods can only be produced with longer processes of production. For example, you can't produce automobiles very quickly, nor laptops, nor MRI machines, nor iPhones. Okay. So therefore, okay, so conclusion, people will only use the longer processes of production. Okay, because people don't want to wait. People would rather have things sooner than later. So they'll only use the longer ones if they are sufficiently more productive, which means that they yield a greater quantity of the same goods, or they allow you to produce new goods that you could not produce in the shorter time. Okay, so they have to be more productive in the shorter processes. So there has to be enough of these extra goods or these new goods in the longer process to overcome the fact that people have to wait longer for them. So let me just give you one more diagram here. And then, so here's one with this diagram for tonight. This is how people go about choosing production processes. Okay, so on top row, we have production processes that are more productive and then production processes that are less productive. Okay, more productive is always good for human beings. This is the law of total utility. Less productive is worse for human beings, less preferred. On the other hand, we have shorter versus longer. Shorter processes are always preferred by human beings, although things equal, because they're going to wait, there's a law of time preference. And longer processes are less preferred, because you have to wait longer, and that means you have to give up current satisfaction. But they're at war with one another. Okay? Obviously, if you go here, to a more productive, shorter processes, human beings will always adopt all more productive, shorter processes. So they'll exploit all of them first, because they're getting more of the good and they're getting it sooner. But pretty soon you run out of those. So then you have to look around and say, well, if I want more production, okay? Well, there are some longer processes that are more productive, okay? Than other shorter ones. So now I'm willing, after I've gotten all the shorter ones that were more productive, I'm willing to look at the longer ones. Okay, and so human beings will adopt some more productive, longer processes of production, especially if they allow them to get new goods that they couldn't get with the shorter ones. And here, they're willing to take some shorter ones that are less productive because they're faster. What they will never do, because it defies both the law of marginal utility, I'm sorry, the law of total utility and the law of time preference, they will never adopt less productive, longer processes of production. So this is out, okay? We don't do that. We do this first, and then we begin to, as we get more and more resources, allocate our resources to longer, more productive, or to shorter, less productive processes. Okay. I will stop here. Next week, we will complete this discussion of the structure of production and interest rates. I will bring it all together, sort of leaving you hanging here. And then we'll begin to get into the question of the Austrian theory of the business cycle, which is based on this analysis. So I will now endeavor to answer some questions. It takes me a minute here to look at all these questions. One question asked, how is the status of the primary dealer determined? What are the advantages to the bank that is a primary dealer and its customers who get the first shot at the new money, increased purchasing power of those dollars versus getting them later? Now, I don't know exactly how, so to answer the first part, I'm not sure exactly how primary dealers are determined. I don't know what the qualifications are to be accepted by the Fed as a primary dealer. I'm sure you can look that up. You can Google it. But the advantages to being a primary dealer is obvious. You can get a lot of commissions by having a steady market to sell bonds to. Or to buy bonds from. So the Fed is a big dealer, is a big buyer and seller of bonds, and so therefore the banks that deal with the Fed have get a lot more business than they would if they weren't dealing with the Fed. Okay? It had to depend on private entities to make their income. And then the new money then that the banks get, the new reserves, they get those reserves, and they then have that before anyone else. They're able then to lower their interest rates, okay, and still make a profit, and then loan the money out. And their customers now get the new money before any prices have risen in the economy. Okay, we talked about this last week. So the businesses that borrow from these banks are able to get the money at a lower interest rate than before, and they can go out and buy goods and commodities and new equipment and so on before prices have risen. This is sometimes called forced saving. So after the money is through the economy, prices are all going up, you and I find out that we can only buy 10% less, but then these prices have gone up by 10% than before. So we're forced to save 10%, okay? And we don't get any benefit from it. We're spending the same amount of money, but it's 10%, it buys 10% less. Until 18 months down the road, 2 years down the road, when our incomes finally increase, okay, when we finally get some of the new money. Then we're just catching up. Okay. Here's another question. Again, this is on the same topic, where banks, where you find out which banks are primary deals, just Google it. I looked last year, and they list them, okay? You can find out who the primary dealers are. It's not a secret. One of the few things about the Fed that isn't secretive. There's a question about the IMF, which portrays the IMF as a lender of last resort in the world. The IMF is not really a lender of last resort in the world. The IMF gets most of its money from the U.S. and it does the U.S.'s bid. Okay, so it's really, and we saw directly that the U.S., the Fed bailed out directly foreign banks in Scotland, banks in France. So when it really wanted to move quickly, it just went around the IMF. The IMF really doesn't have independent funds of its own, or it has some. But without support from the U.S., it could never fulfill this role as lender of last resort. And I wouldn't really call it a full lender of last resort. In fact, what it does is it bails out countries themselves, the IMF, it prevents them from defaulting. And the reason why it does that, because if they default on their bonds, well, many of those bonds are held by banks in the U.S., okay? So the money goes from U.S. taxpayers to the IMF back through to U.S. banksters, okay? And not just U.S. Banking firms, but other banking firms throughout the world. So that's why they're always bailing out, you know, Greece and Ireland and so on, other countries. They don't want them defaulting on the bonds because that will bring the financial system down. Will adversely affect the U.S. financial system as well as the rest of the world. Okay. Someone asked that despite gold's popularity, peer-to-peer lending, I'm not sure if I know what that is, buying small pieces of loans is preferable. Besides the risk of default, is there any reason to believe it's not a safe investment? I'm not familiar with this peer-to-peer lending. I'm not sort of an investment counselor. I really couldn't tell you if there's any reason to believe it's not a safe investment, except the fact that any investment is risky. But you'd have to know more. You'd have to know the details of who's floating these loans, who they're going to, and so on. Here's a good question. Explain in detail how monetary inflation benefits exporters. It benefits exporters because the foreign exchange market reacts much more quickly to inflation, because they're much more attuned to it. It's a much more speculative market than do prices of domestic commodities. So if the U.S. inflates money supply by 10%, what happens is that prices, it takes a while for U.S. prices to rise by 10%. In the meantime, though, the prices of foreign currencies rise by 10%. People are speculating that, the dollar is going to be less valuable. So they begin to sell a dollar off, the dollar value declines by 10%, which means, especially if the price of goods have not risen yet as a result of that inflation, it means that U.S. prices are about 10% less, even though their domestic price is the same. So the exporters can sell more at the same domestic price. So that's why they're always in favor of a depreciating currency, of expanding the money supply. Mises pointed this out a long time ago, in 1912, and that is that the foreign exchange market is much more apt to react quickly to a change in the money supply. Okay, and that's because foreign exchange, people who operate on that market are continually comparing events in different countries and the likely outcomes on the value of the currency. So if they expect prices to go up by 10% next year, they're going to think that that's going to happen, and they're going to get rid of the dollar today before it loses its purchasing power. And that's going to drive the value of the dollar down towards 10%, by 10% today, before prices have risen, okay, in anticipation of the fact that they are. Okay, and that's why they do that. Someone asked here that TMS, the true money supply, is an interesting way to look at the money supply. How closely does increases in TMS correlate with increases in price levels in the economy? Not just CPI, but housing stocks, etc. Do other measures of money have a higher correlation with changes in price levels? That was not a consideration in developing this. You might want to look at Michael Pallaro, who has done a lot of work in developing the TMS and its empirical implications. So I would go and look. I think he has a website. His name is, you spell his name Pollaro. First name is Michael Pallaro. And he has probably has some interesting graphs and charts that can talk about that. But looking at the way TMS has gone up with MZM, which is the Fed official Fed measure, and M2, which is also an official Fed measure, it's sort of in between the two. Okay, so it doesn't behave a lot differently in most cases than those other monetary aggregates. But for theoretical work, it's much more, and empirical work, it's a much more accurate measure. In other words, I don't know to what extent you can use this as an investment tool, though Pallaro, I think, tries to draw out its implications as an investment tool. That is, to allow you to know what's going to happen to stock prices, housing prices, and so on. Okay, someone asked here, in your choosing production processes slide, comparing more or less productive with shorter or longer time frames, would it be a theorem of human action that in stable systems that man would tend to get more productive over time? That's a very interesting and important question. What you can say is that all other things equal, as people's incomes increase, as there's economic growth due to people having lower and lower time preferences, there's a stimulus to continue to save even more. So, yes, I think there is a tendency, and I think we see it in history, that the wealthier nations are, the higher their incomes are, the more room there is, or the more likely they are to change, to lower their time preferences and save even a greater proportion of the higher income. Okay? And that in very poor countries, it's very difficult to do much saving. Okay? Because the current consumption needs are so pressing. And keep that in mind, too, that, in fact, we're not talking about saving as the Keynesians do, as if it's never spent or it's hoarded or something. Saving is simply future consumption. Saving is simply producing goods for the future rather than the present. So if you want to really what we're calling present consumption versus future consumption. Saving is simply future consumption. So you could say the ratio of present consumption is the ratio of future consumption. That's a very important Austrian insight. Okay. Then someone asked if I have any thoughts on the Japanese gigantic quantitative easing coming on the global economy. And any justification for nearly doubling of the Japanese currency strength after the Great Earthquake. Let me look at the first part of that first. But the quantitative easing is supposedly for them. What it's designed to do is to drive the value of the Japanese yen down, okay, because it has been strengthening, which hurts its exports, and we talked about why before. So it's basically, we're really going back to a currency war scenario that occurred during the 1930s, where all countries who were in depression attempted to increase their money supply and devalue their currency. So, for example, when Britain devalued their currency in 1931, their prices, their exchange rates fell, but meaning that, that hurt France's exports and helped Great Britain's exports. But, of course, then eventually Great Britain responded. In countries, we had competitive devaluation of currencies. And I think you see that now, a competitive depreciation of currencies. The Swiss, for example, their currency was rising in value tremendously when the U.S. implemented quantitative easing and the euro began to weaken. And even the Swiss were very anti-inflationary, knuckled under to their export firms and began to try to keep the Swiss franc from appreciating, from gaining in value, so that they could export more. And the only way you can do that is simply to buy up the U.S. dollars and the euros. By buying them up, you buy them up by printing more of your money, and you keep their value high by buying them. And in turn, that lowers the value of your currency. So I think that what's happening is that's going back and forth now. Japan is trying to do the same thing. It can only the quantitative easing will mean that there's more money in the Japanese economy and more money to purchase foreign exchange with to keep the value of other currencies up in relation to their own and try to reduce the value of their currency. And regarding the second part, do I see a justification for the doubling of the Japanese currency strength right after the Great Earthquake? I'm not sure if those two events, the strengthening of their currency and the Great Earthquake, were causally related. It may have been that the dollar didn't look good at that time and the euro was, had questions about the soundness of the euro and, whether it was going to be devalued or depreciated tremendously. Okay, so someone asked me, they recall me saying in a lecture that when Nixon dropped the gold exchange standard, when he closed the gold window in 1971, we had a very small supply of gold remaining. How much was it again, and does that include our reserves at Fort Knox? Yes. The figure I've seen is that it had fallen at the beginning of the, at the end of World War II, we had something like more than half of all the gold in the world was in the U.S. It was $25 billion worth. And we had something like $12 billion of foreign liabilities. So we had twice as much gold as necessary to meet people who wanted cash in dollars from the rest of the world. By the end of the 1960s, I think our gold stock was down to $12 billion, and the liabilities were up over $60 billion. And then finally I heard that by 1971, our gold stock had fallen to $9 billion, and our the foreign dollar liabilities were something like $81 billion. So just to refresh your memory on that. You might want to look in a book or in articles by Jacques Rueff, R-U-E-F-F, a friend of Mises and a gold standard economist, very pro-gold standard economist, who advised Charles de Gaulle, the French prime minister. And de Gaulle was the one who, Rueff was the one who convinced de Gaulle to withdraw the gold from the U.S. during the 1960s. And he did do that. He did send, as I said, send a warship to retrieve France's gold. Okay, so here's another question. When a bank's cash increases due to an increase in their reserves, what is the offsetting increase in the liability side of their balance sheet? So when the bank's cash increases, the offsetting liability is the deposits. So let's say I deposit $10,000 at my bank. My bank has now $10,000 more in assets, in cash, and $10,000 more in liabilities. That is, they owe me $10,000 worth of cash. But they'll change the asset side by loaning out, let's say, 90% of that cash. So at the end, the liability side will have $1,000 more of cash reserves and $9,000 more of loans, okay? That is, loans that are owed to them. And on the liability side, and that's on the asset side. On the liability side, they'll have $10,000 more in deposits that they owe to me. And if you look at some of the slides I had up on fractional reserve banking, you'll see that that's the case if you look at those key accounts. Here's a good question. When people talk about demand for money, which is cash balances, do people make distinctions between holding currency and holding a balance in a checking account, since those things are different? No, they don't. In fact, economists see them as both. When you hold currency in your hand, your pocket, or your purse, underneath your mattress, whatever, or in a safe in your home, or you have money in a checking account, they are interchangeable with one another. You can instantaneously retrieve your money from the checking account. You can get it on demand in currency. By going to an ATM machine, by going to the bank itself, by writing a check. So almost all economists consider currency plus checking accounts as part of the money supply, as part of your cash balances. Austrians would add into that, and I'm in favor of this also, savings deposits. That is, you might not be able to write check on these accounts, a savings account, for example. Or there are some savings accounts that are called money market deposit accounts at banks that you can write up to maybe 6 checks a month on or a year, I forget what it is. But those are all part of your cash balances because you can go to an ATM machine, you can go to the bank, you can pull them out immediately, even if you can't write a check on them to pay for them. It's, for example, I've had arguments with a few other Austrians who claim that any deposit that's not checkable, you can't write a check on, shouldn't be part of the money supply because you can't spend it in exchange. Well, I mean, obviously you can't spend your statement. You can't go with your statement to a store and try to pay with your savings account statement. But you can certainly walk down the street and go to the ATM machine. But moreover, even with currency, if you keep your currency in a safety deposit box at a bank, you can't write a check on that currency, but as part of your cash balance, it's currency. Or if you keep it in the savings deposit box, so you have two houses and you can keep it at another home. Or you bury it in your backyard so you can't dig it up right away and spend it, whatever. It's still part of your cash balance. It's still part of regular of immediately spendable money. Okay, just give me 1 second here. Here's a question. Actually, there's another question. Someone asked, can you explain how there can be inflation without a business cycle, as you mentioned in your article on Mises.org today? Yes, there's two types of inflation. There's one that comes through the banking system that affect interest rates. That's when the Fed creates reserves and the bank lends them out. That causes a business cycle because when the bank lends them out, almost all those loans go to businesses that then it pushes down the interest rate, and then the businesses will get this extra money at the lower interest rate, and they begin to purchase capital goods. Okay, but eventually, over time, we'll talk about this, the money gets into the hands of the workers who work on those capital goods, and the consumers' prices rise later on, and that's the only later on. That's the reason for the business cycle, because you continually have money pouring in, pushing up the price of capital goods, pushing down interest rates, and that can't be sustainable. Because once the Fed stops increasing the money supply, what happens is that the consumer goods prices catch up, the interest rate goes up again because if the Fed steps on the brakes, there's no reason why the interest rate would be pushed down. And so there you get the recession. Now, to answer the other question, or the other part of the question, why don't you get that if the government simply prints money up, or if the Fed prints the money up for the government directly? That is, the government can give these bonds or pieces of paper to the Fed and says, you know, give me $100 million. Because then it doesn't go through the banking system initially. Okay, so what happens is that the government then buys more jets, buys computers to guide the jets and so on from Silicon Valley, pays off farmers, subsidizes farmers to grow corn for ethanol. So the money becomes irregular income. It doesn't go through the banks and artificially lower interest rates. The money is then split between saving and consumption, according to their own time preferences. So even though all prices will rise throughout the economy, you don't have a systematic rise of capital goods prices. Okay, all prices go up. So you just have what's called a simple inflation, which is what happened during World War I, World War II, in the U.S. and in and Great Britain and all the European belligerents in those wars. So Mises is very specific about that, and so is Rothbard, that if you just have a simple inflation, if you just print money up and pay the government's bills, basically, there is not a systematic distortion. It doesn't go through the banking system. It has to go through the banking system before it raises prices for there to be a business cycle. And we'll talk more about that when we get the business cycle. But that's a very good question. Now let me just go down. What would be the percentage of reserves you would expect a bank to hold in a true pre-banking scenario? I think if you had true pre-banking and you absolutely had no government interference with banking, I think after a while, banks, after a few business cycles that drove some banks out of business, banks would all begin to hold 100% reserves. That is for the checking deposits and for any savings accounts that people can withdraw immediately. And I think that if they wanted to loan, they would offer more and more certificates of deposit. So they would begin to, you know, they market them now. But so if they wanted to loan money, they would borrow from depositors for 3 months, 6 months, a year. In other words, a certificate of deposit would not mature immediately. You couldn't come in and just take your money at any time. You can't do that today. So by selling certificates of deposit, the people who were loaning the bank money would not be able to spend that money. So that would be true saving. That would not be creating new money. We'd be taking money out of the hands of the person who bought the one-year certificate of deposit, say $100,000, and loaning to business for 1 year, because that money would have to be paid back a year later to repay the certificate of deposit when it comes due. So I think it would be, you know, be very, very near 100%. That leaves the judgment on it. He was very in favor of true free market banking, or true free banking in that sense, without any government regulation whatsoever. And I think because of all the problems inherent in fractional reserve banking, that it would almost be wiped out on its own on the free market. Is buying gold considered consumption savings or investment? What about paying extra principal on mortgage? Buying gold in a fiat money standard is depending on the reason why you're buying it, could be considered savings or investment. Okay, not holding money, not part of your cash balance. It's savings or it's investment because you're buying it with the view to the fact that the view to the belief that there's going to be a continual depreciation of paper money and that the value of gold is going to go up by more than any alternative investment. So I think it's the same reason why you might buy, a collector might buy baseball cards, rare baseball cards, or art, and so on. Okay? If it's done for speculation on the future, consider that investment. If it's done because the person likes to look at the baseball cards or likes to have these card on their wall and there's no thought to investment, I mean, it's all subjective, that would be consumption. And what about paying extra principal on your mortgage? That's saving an investment. You're saving, okay? You're paying up, you're paying off a debt, so in advance. And so that's why that would be considered investing. Okay, here's a softball question. Is the race to the bottom of currency devaluation a necessary consequence of ending the international gold standard? And will the only way to restore sound international trade be to return to commodity standard? Well, I really believe that that's true. I actually, you know, I have nothing, no, I would not qualify that statement in the least. I think currency wars, as we're increasingly seeing, is the natural outcome of competing fiat money regimes. Okay, it's either to go to one money, and we see that it has not worked in Europe. Okay, that's broken down. Europe did that to avoid these currency wars, but that's not working very well. Or it's to go back toward a gold standard. Well, I guess the question is, what do we mean by currency war? Reactionary changes of the amount of currency by the competing states. Well, currency war simply means trying to make your currency cheaper than your trading partner's currency so that you can export more to them and import less from them. Because if your currency is cheaper, it means it buys less of their currency. So your consumers are going to buy less from the foreign country. You're going to import less, and you're going to export more. What you're hoping to do is to have your consumers buy more of the expensive domestic products and put workers back to work. And that, so a currency war not only hurts foreign producers, it also, and helps your exporters, it also hurts domestic consumers who have to pay much higher prices. So if your currency depreciates by 10%, and you have to pay, in the short run, you have to pay 10% more for foreign products. And, okay, well, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you very much for attending. I enjoyed the questions, and I hope to see you next week. Thanks.